You found the Digging Oak Island podcast, podcaster's journey to discover the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. I'm Dave McBride, and I thank you for downloading and listening. As always, I ask that you subscribe to the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Please rate and review us if you would be so kind. And also, I invite you to join me on Twitter and Facebook. You can follow the show on those two platforms, at Digging Oak Island. As you probably guessed, today we're going to discuss episode 2 of the 7th season of The Curse of Oak Island television show. The episode is called Core Values, but before we get to that, every week I ask you to, if you have any questions or anything you need to get directly to me, if you can do so via email, and that is done on diggingoakisland@gmail.com. And I just wanted to answer an email from a listener, Jim, who wrote me, got a couple of emails. This was one that I felt I needed to address more on the air than through writing an email because it was just a little too complex. Jim writes, I was listening to the show. First of all, Jim, thank you so very, very much for listening. Jim writes, I was listening to the episode and talking about episode 11, which was one of the recap episodes of season 6, he said, I was listening to the episode and you made a remark about how the crew that size couldn't have sailed and leave without anyone ever saying anything. I was thinking, what if they sailed there, buried the treasure and left, but encountered a storm and were lost at sea? I wonder if you can research lost ships during certain time periods and come up with a theory on that. First of all, obviously, this is a great question. You know, the point I was making in the episode, in the podcast that Jim is referring to is, you know, depending on the time frame, if you're talking about a time frame when that area of Nova Scotia is inhabited, you know, the mid-colonial period, when you have when you have people living there, to do the kind of work that would be needed to do to dig the money pit, and also to do the kind of work that would be needed to do to create the man-made beach at Smith's Cove, you're talking about a big, long, loud project that would be difficult to completely keep hidden from the local population. That's really the only point I was trying to make. It would have to be a rather large crew. If it were a large crew on a ship, you would see how that would end up being the case. And how could they, if we're talking about the 1760s or 1770s, as the new theories seem to be going, how could a crew have gotten there, done this work, and, skipped off without anybody knowing or hearing? It's a great question. Yes, it's possible that a ship could have been lost at sea. I think the other part of what he's pointing at is that, you know, if you've got all these members of this crew, whether it be a pirate crew or whether it be a clandestine naval group or something like that, how did they get to the point where everybody in this crew who did all this work for months and months managed to keep quiet all this time? Yes, it is possible that I would imagine that a ship could be lost at sea. I don't think that explains the local population knowing about it as well. But, you know, I mean, we're just theorizing at that point. We're just throwing things out there, really. No more than that. He asked if I can do some research on lost ships. People have done that. There is a lot of research on lost ships during that time period. By then, we're really, the governments are really keeping an eye on these things. Plus, you're talking about a time frame where there were wars in between wars, lots of naval engagements. So naval ships obviously would be, records would have been kept of those and the people on there. So far, I have found nothing that leads me to believe that there's such a thing. There are some theories out there. I'm not going to get too deep into them. You've seen one on the show, right? You've seen some things on the show about this in the past. There's been theories regarding, ships manifestos and stuff. Specifically, I take you back to the Top 25 Theories special, and you can hear that on a podcast with the same name that I have just a few episodes ago. I believe it was, in October, Curse of Oak Island's Top 25 Theories. If you look back at that, in past seasons, I think it was last season, Doug Kroll, the researcher that you see on Oak Island, on the Curse of Oak Island show, he brought up the theory of a man named Rochefort called, also known as Duke Danville. This has to do with the French and Indian Wars. It was, part of the mid-18th century. The French launches this sizable fleet, huge fleet to Canada to try to take Nova Scotia back from Britain. Anyway, he comes up with what he finds to be a ship's log or a ship's manifesto or something like that. And it explains about how they had this huge amount of treasure in one of these ships that they were using to fund this mission, really, and any war against the British. And before they went and engaged the British, they dug a pit, a hole, and dumped this all into a hole. Now, it's all right there. As I've said before, this is a great theory. It's got a lot to do with it. And it's absolutely possible that this theory could end up being that somebody, that these guys did this and then they were lost at sea. But as I've said in the past, they were not. We know of some of those guys in that crew that made it home. Obviously there's a reason to not tell anybody about the treasure. But you see where I'm going. There's so many different possibilities here. It would literally have to be a clandestine mission that was completely lost. And the problem there is, Jim, I'm not sure how much research I can really do on something like that. I think some people have done some research on this kind of stuff in the past, including Fred Nolan. Maybe some of that information will come out as the years go by. But I'm not sure how much I can really get into that. And we have another email. This one comes from Gordon. Gordon writes, saw an excerpt from a future program's seeing Marty lower Rick in a long boom excavator without a gas mask down into a hole 50 feet deep. Almost make Rick number 7 on the curse list. They got gold fever so bad that all common sense is gone. And the reason why I bring this up, and thanks for the email, Gordon, is, that's what happens. I mean, a lot of times that's what happens. And people who do these kind of things run this sort of risk of, taking it too far in search of this thing that has turned into their life's work. And, Oak Island is increasingly frustrating to everyone who's ever dug on the island. It's, it gives up little knowledge, precious little treasure, if any at all. And yet it keeps bringing people back for more. Again, thanks for the email. Don't forget, you can email me at diggingoakisland.com. You might just have your question or comment read or answered here on on a future show. So with that, let's talk about this week's episode. Episode 2 is called Core Values, a not-so-clever little pun referring to core drilling being done in the swamp and the coring samples that have us all waiting with bated breath for some evidence of what lies below the swamp after hearing about it for years and years. Now, I'll get to that in a second, but let's first talk a bit about the swamp itself. When the show speaks about the swamp, they almost always talk about Fred Nolan. It was Fred's theory that the swamp was originally a channel between what was once two separate islands. And we may be getting answers, some answers for that theory at least, more in the future. More on that in just a bit. Nolan was a professional and successful surveyor who came to Oak Island in the mid-1960s to take part in the treasure hunt. He soon owned a few plots of land on the north side of the island and began a decades-long feud with Dan Blankenship that resulted in lawsuits and really a lot of allegations from Dan about Nolan's honesty and credibility. Nolan, for many reasons, was very guarded and often rather secretive and even somewhat deceptive about the work he did on the island. Besides using his surveying skills to make some very interesting discoveries, Nolan was also very devoted to researching lost Spanish ships and how they might connect to Oak Island, going back to our email from earlier. Nolan's history on the island is colorful, sorted. There are a lot of different ways people look at it. Maybe we'll get into that as the years go by. It's a really good subject. But again, he's very secretive about a lot of this stuff. So some of it is, the subject itself is difficult. But maybe with his passing and the easing of tensions between the families that, we might get some more of that information, some more of that work, kind of shed a little more light on it. Nolan never shared any of his work with anyone else involved in the hunt until Rick and Marty Lagina. Rick and Marty, I guess, convinced him to get involved. And let's face it, maybe also the History Channel helped in that convincing process. The search on Oak Island went on for over 150 years before the swamp, and the idea of the swamp being a particularly important place of interest in the Oak Island search, really became a thing. And that was almost entirely thanks to Nolan and Nolan alone. Nolan did not own land by the Money Pit or Smith's Cove. So during his years of conflict with the Blankenships, he had no access to those areas. He did, however, own part of the swamp. So that's where he did a lot of his work. After finding what were apparently parts of a ship under the water in the swamp, Nolan came to the conclusion that perhaps one of those Spanish ships he found in his research might have been sailed between the two islands, scuttled, and then for some reason buried under the dirt beneath the swamp. Although I have to say, I've never really heard any theory as to why someone would do that, which was at all convincing to me, but that's besides the point, I guess. Needless to say, it's Nolan's work and his findings that really bring us to where we are in the search during this particular episode, with a huge barge floating a sonic drilling rig out into the middle of the swamp. As we all know, seismic scanning underground in the swamp showed that a quote-unquote anomaly under the actual ground below the water in the swamp had everyone thinking that Nolan just might have been right all along about that ship. Anyone listening to the past episodes of this show will know how skeptical I personally was of that idea all along, and my skepticism proved to be warranted. Drilling samples showed nothing to indicate that this anomaly was in a ship of any kind. Once again, these kinds of scans and tests proved to be disappointing. This happens a lot in the show, and I know it can be frustrating for all of us. But just imagine how much it has happened to others who have dug and toiled on Oak Island over the years, you know, often digging with hand shovels. It's part of the hunt. It's the best ideas and the best information has always spawned excitement and confidence only to lead to frustration. And now we, the viewers, get to share in those same frustrations, really. Did I want this to be a ship? Of course I did. How amazing would that have been? Eating some crow in return for discovery like that is a trade I would make any day. But while we must always remain a bit skeptical, you know, there is also one thing, and one thing only to do when you get data like these guys got from the seismic scanning under the swamp. And they did exactly that one thing. They went and they had a look. You have to try and see what's causing these anomalies. Even if you don't have any confidence in them, you just never know. And you'll never, ever really know until you give it a try and give it a look. Now, we can say that at least these particular, you know, pieces of data do not indicate a ship. And there is, in fact, a far less fantastical answer to these questions. And we can really cross that one off the list now. And that's always a good thing in what seems to be sort of an ever-expanding search on Oak Island. It's nice to put something to the side. The swamp isn't done, though. Although I'm starting to think that, like Marty Lagina, and I'm starting to wish maybe it was. The core samples did open up the possibility of truly being able to date the swamp, meaning answering once and for all, if Oak Island really was two separate islands brought together through some sort of man-made workings. So they turned to a man named Dr. Spooner of Acadia University in Nova Scotia, someone Rick called a swamp expert. I'd love that job. It's and Dr. Spooner is intrigued by the dirt brought up by the coring samples, and he's going to go test it and see what it turns up. And those answers should be fascinating for sure. I can't wait to hear more about it. Besides simply looking like two islands, let's face it, it does. When you view it from the right angle, you know, and a lot of different angles, when you view it, it does look like two islands. The episode also pointed out two more interesting bits of evidence of this possible theory. One, and I wasn't really aware of this one. Maybe I forgot about it. But the east and the west sides of the island, the two separate islands, if you were talking in those terms, are apparently made of very different stuff. The east side, where the money pit is, that's made of the softer clay, while the west is made of a much harder rock. Now, I'm no geologist, but that does seem at least somewhat curious. Also, the samples brought up were bone dry, seriously bone dry, and only a matter of a couple of feet under the water. Everyone who frankly knows more than I do about this seems to think that might be unusual and just may indicate that the water really hasn't been there for all that long, at least, you know, not in geological terms. Having said all that, swamps like this are commonplace in Nova Scotia. So commonplace, in fact, that they have their own name for it. The term is Barachois, and it's basically an Atlantic Canadian province's word for these very sorts of sort of coastal lagoons or swamps that are right up along the ocean, but mostly cut off, if not entirely cut off from the ocean, by some kind of small land barrier or a sandbar or something like that. In the war room, at the end of the episode, everyone agrees they aren't done with the swamp. If we can, in fact, determine the swamp's age, this is information worth having. Let's hope Dr. Spooner has something to say in the future. But don't fear, my friends. We have more aggravatingly non-specific data results to chase after. Craig Tester, along with a few other members of the crew, bring two guys, one named Don Johnston and the other Steve Watson, from Global GPR Services into Smith's Cove and to the Cave and Pit area to do a scan using ground-penetrating radar. The company's out of Ontario, I think, and they describe the basics of GPR like this. Quote, ground-penetrating radar uses a high-frequency radio signal that is transmitted into the ground, and reflected signals are returned to the receiver and stored on digital media. The computer measures the time for a pulse to travel to and from a target, which indicates its depth and location. The reflected signals are interpreted by the system and displayed on the unit's LCD panel. To put it even more simply, really, for all of us, it's another one of these things, not unlike seismic scanning, that will give the team really nothing more than potential and sort of non-specific targets to dig and explore. It doesn't do anything more than locate potential anomalies. This is a word we're starting to get used to here. They find a few in Smith's Cove, which honestly, we have seen many times before with little results ever shown on the air for those little targets or anomalies. And they also find one near the Cave and Pit area, which is the most interesting for Tester and the team. Now, it is fascinating, honestly, how little we've heard or seen of the Cave and Pit during the lifespan of this show, especially since it sits in such close proximity and really on an imaginary line sort of directly in between Smith's Cove and the Money Pit. So a little background, you heard a little bit in the show. In 1878, a woman named Sophia Sellers, who they say is Sophia, okay, who was the daughter of Anthony Graves. If you don't know who that is, Graves was a longtime property owner on the island. He owned the land the Money Pit is located on, and he's actually the guy who bought that land from John Smith, the original discoverer of the Money Pit. Sophia was plowing with a couple of her oxen when an apparent 10-foot deep and 8-foot wide sinkhole opened up underneath them, and her and the oxen fell in. Don't worry, they got them all out and then eventually filled it all in with boulders so it wouldn't happen again. Now, even though sinkholes are fairly common, considering where this particular pit is located, specifically 350 feet east of the Money Pit and about 170 feet west of the Smith's Cove, considering that, this led many to conclude it is somehow related to the flood tunnels leading to the Money Pit. The show presents the long-held theory originating with treasure hunter Frederick Blair that it is evidence of something like an air shaft dug to assist the original diggers of the Money Pit in the flood system. In 1893, Blair and his Oak Island Treasure Company decided to get a better look at the Cave and Pit, cleared away those boulders used for the filling, and dug down to about a bit more than 50 feet or so. Along the way, he claims to have found pick marks that are in the clay that are similar to those that were found in the Money Pit. These are marks that sort of show that somebody was digging there. But soon, again, like the Money Pit, seawater broke through the bottom of it and filled the pit up to the tide level, again, leading researchers to draw this connection with the flood tunneling system and the Money Pit. I also remember reading, and I can't remember where, that when one of the searchers had the idea of exploding dynamite in Smith's Cove to try and, destroy the flood system, and block it up at its source, that the water in the Cave-In Pit then kind of gurgled or what have you, leading them to believe that it was more evidence that the Cave-In Pit was connected somehow to the flood system. In later years, Robert Dunfield in the 1960s tried to dig down in the cave-in, the cave-in pit, and get some answers. And then again, Dan Blankenship, not long after that, both little results and never went back to it. It's an interesting spot. It's worth exploring in my mind. The guys from Global GPR find a target that, quote, looks like it has a top and a bottom to it, calling it a possible tunnel at just about 90 feet deep. Rick Lagina says it, quote, can't get more exciting than that. So there you go. Time to get excited, I guess. Now we have another of Gary Drayton's finds to talk about. Two, in fact. Gary takes Rick and Dan Henske out to Lot 21 to Metal Detect, a place where they've searched before with really great results, honestly. They find what at first looks like two big iron bricks with a hole in each of them. And as Drayton starts to fiddle with it, they begin to look like the heads of some kind of maybe antique sledgehammer or something to that effect. So they bring one of my favorite side characters so far back on the show as blacksmithing expert Carmen Legg, a man with one of my all-time favorite maritime accents, honestly, comes to the war room, and the team lays out on the table nearly every one of these kind of blacksmith-type iron tools that they found over the years, all for him to examine. He identifies Drayton's finds as two examples of something he calls a swage. These are kind of hard for me to explain here in an audio format, but essentially what a swage is, it's something that's used to form metal into shapes that you just can't do by just hitting it with a hammer. Legg says these particular kind of swages are used to sharpen specifically rock drills, tools one would use for a, quote, major mining or tunneling operation, unquote. It's an interesting conclusion, especially when you consider what we said before about the two different makeups of the island. The two separate islands, if we use that theory. The east side, where the money pit is where one would expect to find evidence of tunneling and the like, such as something like these tools. But you wouldn't need something like these tools over there because the money pit is essentially softer dirt and clay that doesn't require this kind of tool. But over by Lot 21, where this was found, the rock under the ground is much harder and would require this type of tool. But that's not where the tunnels on the island are, right? Well, so we all think, who knows? You see where I'm going here. It opens up the possibility of underground searching in even more areas than just over by the money pit in the immediate area. But I certainly hope, let's be honest, that they would need more than a couple of old tools to convince them to go down that hole, so to speak, metaphorically and literally. He also says that they are a very rare find for the area. In fact, he says they will, quote, not find these items on any other islands around here, end quote. So there is an interesting conclusion we can draw from this, if Mr. Legg is in fact correct, and I have no reason to doubt him or his expertise. These tools are not common, yet we have two on Oak Island. Now, I don't want to sound like the narrator here, but doesn't that mean that a, quote, unquote, major mining or tunneling operation probably took place here and only here on Oak Island? I mean, this just at least seems to be evidence of that. Maybe the most fascinating thing Legg said was that these swages were crude and certainly very old. According to Legg, a swage like this would have been used as far back as the 1400s and only really up until the mid-18th century, after the mid-18th century, 1750 is what he says, then, you know, after that point, you would have been able to notice a difference in them. In fact, he says the oldest thing on the table of these different artifacts they found are these swages. So why would they be on an island that, as far as we know, was inhabited mostly by cows before the 1780s? And what could they possibly have been used for? Meaning, where is this major mining or tunneling operation exactly located? These are all good questions. Now, if you guys have been listening to this podcast, you'll know I'm not one to overstate these finds from the show, but I love this find. Maybe more than any other Drayton found, you know, any other thing that Drayton has ever found. I can make a good case for many plausible and mundane reasons why things like old coins or military buttons, jewelry, and even old religious pieces would be found on an island like this. But this find is not only apparently very rare and very old, it has a very specific use and therefore tells an actual story. So if we're to believe that someone long ago came to this island and dug some elaborate and difficult to dig underground workings, this is real evidence of that. Gotta say cheers to Gary Drayton on this one. So as they say, I guess one door closes and a couple more open. Despite the fact that it appears the ship in the swamp, which I like to call the SS Matty Blake, is not a ship after all. And that door may be about to close on us. But now with this episode, it seems like we have even more to think about with the opening of a couple more doors and a couple more areas of research and places to explore. The Swages Drayton found on Lot 21 tell a story, one of major tunneling and digging. And that means Laginas might be about to investigate beneath the west side of the island, an area not really ever looked into all that much during this really 200-plus year history of the hunt. I can't say for sure they'll find much here in that area, but who am I to say? Regardless, it's new territory, and it will be interesting in any event. When we saw the footage of the Season 7 trailer, and this was one we talked about in one of the earlier emails at the top of the show, we saw a seriously big hole being excavated, and I couldn't quite place exactly where it was from the footage on the trailer. It seems after this episode, though, it may in fact be the cave-in pit. Go back and watch the trailer again. This might be the spot where we spend the bulk of this year's real major work. It's exciting stuff, and let's see what comes out of this. It's, again, another door opening and a really interesting one. So that's going to do it for this episode of Digging Oak Island. Next week, I won't be around to do a show specifically about episode 3. I'm so sorry about this, but I'm going to be away. I'm going to be on vacation with the family. I won't be able to get to recording and editing and all that, but we'll catch up on the week 4. However, watch this feed. I'll be posting a great conversation I had just today with an old friend of mine about Oak Island. I think you're going to like it anyway. Please subscribe to the show anywhere you get your podcasts. And if you do enjoy the show, please rate and review us on iTunes or wherever you listen. It really helps get the word out on the show. I want to thank a listener who on one of the Facebook pages where I wrote this pointed out that I was not on, I think it wasn't Google Play, but there's a couple that I'm not on. So if you're not finding the show on the podcast software that you like to use, then let me know and I'll do my best to try to get it posted on there. Sometimes it's hard to keep up with all of them. You can also follow us, like I said, on Facebook. We're at Digging Oak Island. Give us a like there. That would be much appreciated. It's a great place to leave your comments and questions about each episode for us to discuss. You can also find us on Twitter. We are at Digging Oak Island over there. If you have any questions or comments that you want to send directly to me rather than via social media, you can certainly do so through email. It's diggingoakisland@gmail.com. So until we speak again, I'm Dave McBride. Thank you so much for listening to Digging Oak Island.